And now on Tucson Business Radio X, your home for real estate with Carol Nugent.
And welcome, everyone, to your home for real estate, or as I like to call it, your radio home for real estate. My name is Carol Nugent, and I'm delighted today to be discussing the issue of what is going on 4th Avenue in Tucson, our beloved 4th Avenue. Lots of change, lots of controversy, and I think that it's time that those of us who live in the Tucson area who hear about it but don't really know what's going on to learn a little more. And so today I'm very pleased to welcome three guests. My first guest is Shannon Riggs, who is the chair of the Historic 4th Avenue Coalition, and Dee Dee Kanan, who is a founding member of the Historic 4th Avenue Coalition. And Dee Dee and Shannon are also the co-owners of PopCycle, which is one of my very favorite shops on 4th Avenue. And Shannon and Dee Dee are united in their mission to preserve the unique identity of Historic 4th Avenue and the surrounding area, while continuing to promote smart, sustainable growth that will benefit these districts and Tucson as a whole. They are dedicated to educating the community and all of us about the issues that are pertinent and advocating for concrete solutions that serve the entire Tucson area. And they bring a broad, long-term vision of what development can look like in Tucson, in which developments can and must benefit the community, creating synergistic, cooperative relationships between developments and the neighbors they inhabit. The Historic 4th Avenue Coalition believes that the purpose of development is to bring measurable improvement to the community, and the way to do that is by demanding accountability and transparency. Furthermore, it is the role of the public sector with citizen input to guide urban growth so it is done in the wisest and most equitable manner. Dee Dee and Shannon see their function as presenting best practice information that's needed for government and community stakeholders to make informed choices, work positively and collaboratively to reach mutually agreeable outcomes, and to raise the standard for future projects. This approach is critical, and by working together, they believe that we as a community can build something superior to what any of us can achieve alone. And welcome, Dee Dee and Shannon. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
I love your mission statement. And my third guest is Henry Wartchen, who is a board member of the Historic 4th Avenue Coalition. And he serves as the secretary of the coalition. He's also a board member for West University neighborhood, which is right next to his 4th Avenue. And Henry has lived in the West University and the 4th Avenue area since 1997. So yes. Welcome, Henry, and thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Carol.
As I said, I'm delighted to be approaching this topic because I really do feel like there is so much going on in Tucson. And I'm a relative newcomer. I've only been in Tucson for 5 years, but I have a tremendous affection for the city. I think I've told you I'm a sponsor of Meet Me at Maynard's because I really want to support the community and the development and the thriving of our downtown community. I feel, having lived in many other cities outside of Tucson, I'm here by choice, and I love it, and I don't want to see it change. I want Tucson to be Tucson. I've lived in major metropolitan areas, the Chicago area, the Bay Area, the Denver area. And one of the reasons I love living in Tucson is because of what Tucson is. So I thought the best way to approach this is maybe to start with a little bit of history. And I don't know if Henry, are you the one that can speak to the history of 4th Avenue in general? You've been in the area for a long time. And also then we'll go into sort of the history of what's been going on with some of the changes.
Yeah, I can speak maybe not as long because I know Dee Dee, the y'all's family have owned the property much longer than I've been in the area. So, but since I'll actually put a little bit of personal perspective to it. When I was coming to Tucson and, you know, we lived in Sierra Vista and we would pack the kids up in the car to come look at places. And one of the places we were looking was West University. And, you know, so we wanted to, you know, like the character of an old house. But it was my very first visit, I remember, to 4th Avenue, specifically to a Brooklyn Pizza. And I walked in that place, and just the ambiance of the place and the avenue, I was immediately, you know, this is where I want to live. Mm-hmm. And so we kind of all of a sudden focused our efforts just there on 4th Avenue. And we've been, like you said, since 97. So, and I'm pleased to say that for the most part, I've seen it largely stay the same and maintain that character and that charm. But it started to become alarmed recently because all of a sudden we have high rises being built, and it just is a little bit out of character. So I wanted to try and, you know, find some way to get involved. So I initially got involved through West University, and then we kind of, you know, it was really somewhat of an ad hoc relationship with Shannon and Dee Dee with other merchant owners and other neighborhood associations. And we realized quickly that people will listen to us if we spoke with a common voice. Mm-hmm. And therefore formed the Historic 4th Avenue Coalition. Mm-hmm. So that's a little bit of perspective, at least from 97 to here. Mm-hmm. And so now, you know, we're actively involved trying to preserve that charm and the character and to make mm-hmm. sure that it isn't compromised. And because like you said, I've lived in those other areas as well, and none of those areas had that initial charm, again, that 4th Avenue had for me. Mm-hmm. It was a very personal connection. So. Mm-hmm.
Great, thank you. Well, Dee Dee, do you want to add anything to that? I have a little bit of history, but I'd love to hear what you have to say.
Sure. My parents bought the building that PopCycle's in now, that also houses the Sterling Winch, in the 70s. And so my parents were antique dealers, and they had a store there for many years on the avenue, and then, you know, proceeded to own the building. And so, and then my mom in the 90s had a club called the 4th Avenue Social Club that was there for probably 5 or 6 years. Mm-hmm. So our family has had a long history with the avenue. And so I think that's one of the reasons why we're so protective about just really being conscientious about the 4th Avenue is its own ecosystem. And we have to be very careful about not disturbing that and making sure that that ecosystem is respected.
Mm-hmm. Did you want to add anything, Shannon?
I went to the U of A in the late 80s, early 90s. So 4th Avenue, main gate wasn't what it is mm-hmm. now. So 4th Avenue was where everybody went to shop and hang out. And and then I know that it went through a bit of a rough time in the later 90s, which is when I wasn't living here, and then we moved back. And so, yes, and now it's got a whole new life. I feel that 4th Avenue has really started to thrive with a big diversity of businesses, which is great that it didn't always, that it had, and then I think it lost, and then it's getting back. We've got a new gallery coming, a new cider bar coming to 4th Avenue. So I think that, yes, it ebbs and flows, but I feel like it's gotten to a really nice, very robust point right now, and we just want to make sure that we maintain that.
Uh-huh. And my understanding is that 4th Avenue really came into being after the underpass was built in 1916.
Makes sense.
And because of its proximity to the railroad, it really became a commercial district because it was the logical place with the goods coming in right in the transportation center.
Yes.
And, you know, with the access to the avenue. And so it really did become quite a thriving commercial district. And as you said, it sort of fell back, and now it's starting to have a reemergence.
Uh-huh.
But what is it going to reemerge as? I think that's the question.
Yeah, our building was the Piggly Wiggly grocery store.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, when was it built? 1920. So, and when you look at photos of 4th Avenue from back then, because people went, I think before the Piggly Wiggly even, they had to go to a different market for different things, right? Mm-hmm. So there's all these different, it was just markets, markets, markets that all carried different things. There were a lot of Chinese merchants on 4th Avenue back in the early days. So it's got a really long history and super interesting, if you ever delve into it, just all kinds of interesting stuff, you know, that went on down there. So.
It's kind of ironic that that was the Piggly Wiggly because you're right next to the co-op.
That's right. That's right. The modern day Piggly Wiggly.
So
the co-op's about to have their 50th anniversary also. I think it's next year.
That's impressive.
Yeah.
That's tremendous.
Mm-hmm.
That's tremendous.
Yeah, we love the co-op.
And help me with this, but based on all of my research, my understanding is that certainly one of the precursors to some of the change is that some of the businesses haven't made it.
Yeah.
And so as businesses have failed, As the economy has changed and it's become much more of a digital economy, and you weren't here, but my initial venture with Radio X was in a program talking about how the digital culture has changed real estate. So I have a real soft spot in my heart for that one. But as businesses started to fail, that kind of opened the door for developers to come in. And that was aided, really, by some of what was going on legislatively, both at the state level and in terms of the city council. And if I'm correct, in 1996, Arizona passed the original GPLET. There are a lot of acronyms, and I'm gonna make sure that we spell them out. And a GPLET, which is a government property lease excise tax, which is the big fancy word for it. But basically what it does is it allows a developer to come in and basically occupy a property, develop and then occupy a property for up to 8 years with no taxes if it's in a central business community, which Historic Fourth Avenue is part of the Tucson central business community. So it really opened the door to a lot of people who were investors, basically, which I see that as one of the major challenges, as you've all been describing. Fourth Avenue went from, if not a familial family, certainly a community family sense. And when you create legislation that allows outsiders to come in, that can really threaten that community. And help me if I have this wrong, but I understand then that the GPLET was amended in 2018. I don't know if you're familiar with any of that.
Yeah, we're not. I mean, we know what the GPLET is, but we don't really. More versed. Oh, I can't.
Well,
speak
and
for
it,
we, but
it may not even apply to Tucson. You know, because the GPLET was an Arizona legislative piece, that amendment may have been more pertinent to specific business centers, and that could have, in fact, been pertinent to Phoenix rather than Tucson.
We're still learning about the GPLAT. Yeah. I'll point as an example. We were previously understanding that when the developer committed to that, they could not sell the property. And all of a sudden we found out, no, they can sell the property.
Well, according to what I know, that's really interesting because according to my information, the developer doesn't own the property.
Yes. Exactly.
That's correct, but they can sell the rights in the property to somebody else, and basically what they're selling is the value of those GPLAT tax incentives.
They're two things. They're selling whatever is left on the 25 years duration and whatever is left of the 8 years of the tax-free. And then once the tax-free expires, they just pay the excise tax, which is a formula based on the square footage of the building, which is certainly much less than if you're paying property taxes.
Right.
Which brings up another way that the GPLET really affects the avenue, because as developers come in and values increase, then the taxes to the other merchants
goes up.
And we've just recently had a couple of businesses that are leaving because they can't afford it. And I haven't heard about the deli, if that was the case, but I know that there are other merchants on the avenue that have cited that as a real threat to their maintaining their businesses. Have you seen that with PopCycle?
The taxes have increased since the streetcar came in. I think there was a expectation about what that was going to do to the district. Personally, I haven't seen that influx of people that it was supposed to bring to us. So taxes from then have like gone up every single year. So my parents, have had you know a difficult time with because then it gets passed down to whoever the renter is, which is us in this case. So
your parents still own that building?
They do.
Wow.
But we pay rent.
And the GPLET is a complicated animal. I mean, we're not necessarily opposed to GPLETs, but they have to be used in an equitable manner. And so when development comes into an area and we're giving them tax incentives or incentives to build in an area, we need to make sure that that thing fits into the area that it's coming into, that it's appropriate, and also that thing is going to interact with the neighborhood or the district that it's coming into. in our opinion, I think that we need to look a lot more closely at when that happens and how that happens and how we give those away. And I know that they do an economic evaluation to see if it's viable or not, but there really isn't any tangible evidence coming back saying that these incentives are actually making the community more prosperous. Mm-hmm. So, and we don't feel like these things should be given away mm-hmm. without real expectations about what they need to live up to.
And well, actually, I was going to add to that. Mike Peel, who's on our, mm-hmm. In our coalition, had passed this along, but there's actually studies have shown the exact opposite. There is no correlation between GPLET and economic development. And the only correlation they found in the data set they looked at was a correlation to the poverty rate. So that's very striking, the fact that everything you think the GPLET is supposed to do, mm-hmm. it is not getting those tangible benefits.
So. Well, and what I really hear you saying is that it's a partnership.
Sure.
Yeah, or it should be a partnership.
It should be.
And I'm old enough to know that any partnership is successful because there's mutuality.
Definitely.
And it's one thing to say, well, our development is going to create jobs, it's going to create traffic, it's going to bring this and
people.
Such and this and
yeah.
such. And that's all a projection.
Correct.
Exactly.
But you don't know.
Uh-huh. Until it happens.
Until it happens. You know, I once thought I really wanted to get married. I projected that I would have a wonderful marriage. And then it happened. And there wasn't any mutuality. So I no longer have a partnership. And I'm glad that you brought that up. I think that's really key. And I'm also aware that another piece of legislation that affects what's going on is the IID, the Infill Incentive District, which again, 4th Avenue, and I think the Warehouse District.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And
yeah.
Would you like to take a stab at defining that? I'm happy to, but if
Shannon's probably in a better
okay,
position.
Okay, Shannon.
She's very well versed.
Great.
So the IID is a zoning overlay, mm-hmm. and what it does is it, if a developer wants to use the IID, they have to meet certain qualifications to do it. But in exchange for that, they get kind of a streamlined process through, you know, the city as far as getting on the road to getting their project built.
Their permits and
yes,
their zoning.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And the IID has a lot of good things in it. It was intended and it has basically done what it's intended to do. To protect the historic district. So because 4th Avenue is a fairly newly crowned historic preservation zone.
Was
so
that in
maybe 6 years?
2016,
I believe so.
It was.
Yeah, it hasn't been that long. So anyone building under the IID would not be able to destroy a historic structure.
Correct.
And if they wanted to do that, they'd have to go through a whole different process. So that protects a lot of the buildings on 4th Avenue. And it has a lot of design specifications, open space and things of that nature. But it doesn't, unfortunately, there's a lot of ways for developers to kind of loophole through some of those open, like especially open space, which is one we've talked about a lot because we feel like walkability, open space, placemaking are so important yep. to what we're talking about. And the open space requirement actually can be inside of the project, mm-hmm. inside of a gated, locked off project. So for instance, the union that's going in the flycatcher project. It's sad that all these projects are named after the things that got torn down for mm-hmm. them to go there. But all their open space is on the inside, which is great for the people who live there, but not great for the people who walk by it. But, you know, so because of the IID, we couldn't get a lot of influence on design issues as much as we would like to. So what we worked with on the union was more ideological issues about localism and yep. and things like that. And so, which was great. And we got a lot of good things out of that CBA, which I'm sure we'll talk about mm-hmm. At some point. But the IID, what it's really good for is adaptive reuse. It's great for that, which mm-hmm. is when you take a building that's, mm-hmm. you know, there and you fix it up and you can change the use very easily, which is great. The parking requirements are reduced, which used to be a real problem for anyone who was putting in a food or drink establishment. The parking mm-hmm. requirements were very restrictive, making it difficult for people to put in a new food or drink place along Fourth Avenue when they're trying to change the use of a building. So the adaptive reuse, it's been fantastic. And there are a lot of examples of great, I believe, that the Clifton used the IAD, which is not on on South Fourth, I guess.
I think Revel used it.
Revel used it.
McCoy Hotel.
The McCoy. Yeah. And
I didn't realize the McCoy did.
Which is the IAD goes all the way over there. That's interesting.
Yeah, I didn't know it was on the west side.
Yeah,
that's interesting.
I didn't know either. And
makes me wonder if
it does
some
go
of
down Stone too, though. I believe.
Yeah, it does. I believe, yes.
Anyway, there's lots of great examples of adaptive reuse, which has really helped take spaces that people couldn't get into before because they're like, I want to have a bar here, but with the parking requirement, it's just never going to happen. Mm-hmm. And a restaurant, and we're able to do that, which has helped bring that diversity to the avenue, I think, that we were talking about earlier.
And I think that the intent of the IID is a very good one, because my understanding is that the reason that IIDs came to be is it was a way to fight suburban sprawl.
Exactly.
Where developers could just, you know, I mean, Tucson is a great example of a city. I'm a realtor. I can't keep up with all of the sprawl right now.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, and so I think that to do anything to protect the core of Central Tucson. So the intention is very, very good.
Right.
Yes.
And maybe you're the person, and I certainly welcome Dee Dee and Henry, but I'm wondering if you're the person to help our listeners understand what is the relationship between or the differences between the GPLAT and the IID. How does that...
Yeah.
I kind of got the feeling that the developer had a choice by what you were saying.
Well,
and I'm sure that's not the case.
Yeah, they don't. What they have a choice between using the underlying zoning and using the IID.
Or
developing a PAD.
Right.
Which is a whole nother process. So yeah. The IID is an incentive. So what it is it's kind of a way, because of Prop 207, the city can't really, which we haven't talked about Prop 207, we could just go so far down the rabbit hole here. But Prop 207 basically says that if a city or a municipality, I think the state even, makes any kind of restriction on the zoning on a piece of land, that would cause the developer, the person owning it, to lose money, they can take legal action against that, the city. Or the state. So it has really restricted what our city can do as far as being able to put restrictions on developers about open space and things like that. So the IID created all these good design standards that you have to use if you want to use the streamlined process, which is great. So it's an incentive. So any kind of incentive is what the developer's choosing to use that incentive, right? So they're not being forced. It's not being forced upon them. Mm-hmm. So the GPLAT has been used within the IID, and it hasn't. I mean, I think that a lot of the city's attitude about the IID was, you're already getting an incentive. Maybe you don't get a GPLAT as well. But in the case of the union, they did. But then we may have had something to do with that.
And that's what I was going to ask you about. Did the union get the GPLAT?
They did,
yes,
because they negotiated the community benefits agreement with us. Okay. I mean, the city was pretty resistant, I think, to granting them that if they hadn't gone through that process with us. And they said that they wouldn't be able to build the project without the GPLAT, that they would have to walk away from the project that everyone had invested a lot of time into, that the people that were selling that property were expecting to sell that property. If it had just fallen apart, it would have been a lot for, I mean, Plush was already closed. Things had been torn down. It was kind of deep in even before the property closed. So it would have been very problematic for a lot of people. So, yeah, I think that's kind of where the city stands on the IID, but I don't want to, like, you know, speak out of school. But that kind of, if you're already using the IID, then, you know, the GPLAT's kind of, that's... But I think people have used it within the IID, but not very many, I don't think.
Well, the IID is very generous to the developer, and
exactly,
is protective
already
of the community.
Exactly, already. And that's kind of where the city stands.
And then what we find is, after that generosity, the developers are coming in asking for exceptions even from those requirements.
Yeah,
so,
yeah. Exactly.
Which is why your passion is so important, which is why I wanted to do this program. Because, as you said earlier, Dee Dee, I don't think anybody here is against development.
No.
I mean, it's very exciting. I I've been here 5 years. I started sponsoring Meet Me at Maynard's because when I got here, there wasn't a lot on Congress.
Yeah.
You know, there were a lot of empty storefronts, and I attended the event as a new resident. And I immediately saw that there was so much historic value, but it needed to be supported. Mm-hmm. And that's when I decided that I would become a sponsor.
Yeah.
And it's just amazing. It's very exciting now to see what's happened with the downtown area.
Yeah.
And I intend to do a program on that at some point, too. But it has to continue to reflect, you know, Tucson. I don't know about anyone else at the table, but I really don't like Phoenix. I'm in Tucson because I, you know, I've lived in some of the largest metropolitan areas in the country.
Yeah.
And Phoenix is now the fourth largest metropolitan area in the country.
Yeah.
And
it's a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
You think so?
And I make a living off of helping people purchase property here, which I'm very happy to do.
Yeah.
But I also really want to do what I can to help protect Tucson, and so that it doesn't lose its identity.
I think that's one of the wake-up calls with developers who are used to dealing with Phoenix and Scottsdale, and they think they're dealing with just Arizona, and they don't understand how Tucson's different. So
Well, let me ask you, Dee Dee. Shannon alluded to the CBA, which stands for Community Benefits Agreement. So tell us a little bit about what a community benefits agreement is and how it's come into play in the Fourth Avenue issues.
Well, basically, is my parents, because of the proximity of this, of Flycatcher, got notice that this was going to happen. And when it did, I reached out to Michael Peel, who is the director, the Southern Arizona director of Local First. To talk about localism, how to protect it, and he kind of came up with, he was brainstorming about some ideas of other cities that have done things like this to protect areas like ours. For example, you know, what happened, I don't know if you know, but like what happened to Mill Avenue, what used to be very similar to Fourth Avenue, and they didn't do a lot to protect it, and now it's really has a lot of chain stores. It's not, it doesn't have the same flavor. It doesn't have, it doesn't have the same traffic. So basically, they took something that was really unique and kind of made it generic.
Mm-hmm.
So Mike had some suggestions about things that we could use, toolboxes, you know, like a toolbox of things that we could use to try and mitigate if this was going to happen, like how we had it, how we could have it happen in a way that was more equitable for the community. So one of his ideas was the CBA, which he had seen used in other cities, usually on bigger, like larger scale projects, where a coalition of different stakeholders came together with a certain amount of asks, and they bring those to the developer. And so it's an agreement between local individuals, so individual groups, and a developer. Mm-hmm. The city doesn't really have anything to do with that because of, like Shannon's saying about Prop 207, makes it very difficult for the city to implement or impose restrictions that maybe another city could do because they don't have that same restrictions,
right.
Basically. So, so basically the community benefits agreement seemed to be the best tool that we could use to have our voices heard and to have the voice of Tucson kind of heard about this project.
And that was pretty successful with the Union Building, if I'm correct.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't easy. There was also FAMA, the Fourth Avenue Merchants Association, and I think that they were going to have an agreement, like just basically kind of more like what a neighborhood agreement would have if like something was coming in. So just between one entity and the developer. And so I think that FAMA was looking about doing something like that. And at the time, we kept saying, you know, you're not engaging your merchants. You're not asking them what they want. You're not including the neighborhoods because great streets do not happen unless you have good neighborhoods to support them. It's a symbiotic relationship. We can't have one without the other. And to pigeonhole one thing is very, I think it undermines everything about what community can be. So we started working on, you know, talking to the neighborhoods around us and seeing where they were. And then that's how we kind of
I'm assuming that's how you got connected with Henry.
Yeah.
Through that process. Thank goodness.
And Iron Horse. And yeah. And so, so the coalition, so there was a point where it looked like they were going to use the language of a CBA, but just enter just that entity and FEMA, which is not a CBA because you don't have multiple,
it's not the community, right?
You don't have multiple stakeholders at the table. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't, I have to say, you know, it wasn't the cleanest process. It was kind of messy, and we went back and forth, and we negotiated for a really long time. But I have to say that that the representatives for this development, they spent a lot of time and energy. I mean, it's not easy to make it work with a coalition of a lot of people, but they put the effort in, and I think I'm really proud of what we came up with.
And they're continuing to do that. I know in your mission statement, one of the things you talk about is transparency. And it was, they just announced, I think it was last week or in the last 10 days, public, you know, meetings where the public is welcome to.
That was part of the CBA, is that so we because, you know, the thing is, when people get scared or frightened is when they don't know what's happening around them. So the more information everybody has access to, the better it is for everything. When you have things happening behind closed doors, that's when things don't work and people feel excluded.
Which is why I have this program and why I'm so delighted to have you all here. And I am Carol Nigut. I am a residential realtor here in Tucson. I love my work. I love this city. I love helping people create home. You know, and that's why I'm doing this wonderful live streaming show on Tucson Business Radio X, and we live stream from the studios at the Stewart Title Building here on East Broadway, right in the heart of Central Tucson. And I'm visiting today with three representatives from the 4th Avenue Historic 4th Avenue Coalition, Dee Dee Kanan and Shannon Briggs and Henry Wirtchen. And I'm going to, I want to turn a little bit now to what's going on with the new Opus building, because that's been in the news a lot. And I know a lot of people just glaze over. Mm-hmm. And that's why I wanted to take this opportunity today. And I know, for example, that you were not able to get a CBA, a community benefits agreement, with the developers of Opus. And I also understand that a part of what happened is there was a little bit of, I'm not sure what word would describe it, but there was a change that happened at the city council meeting, that there was support. Steve Kozacek, I believe, was one of the main supporters, and there was an opportunity to try and convince the council to require the developers of the Opus building to agree to a community benefits agreement. And at the last minute, the developers said, if we don't have a decision today, we might pull the development. And so the council voted. And they passed it because, understandably, the city doesn't want to lose the opportunity, especially because I believe it was in 2009 that the city of Tucson was facing bankruptcy. So obviously the opportunity to develop is very, it's important. But it really, you lost the opportunity to get the CBA.
In fact, maybe add a little bit more context.
Yes,
to that.
Please.
We thought we had another month to basically negotiate an agreement.
Right.
And you're right. It was all of a sudden, very last minute, without any advance notice. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, if the GPLAT is not approved at this meeting, and it isn't so much they would pull the project, but they were going to lose the funding for the project.
Right, right.
So, which would of course cause them to pull out. So. So it's unfortunate that happened, and they did actually pass a motion, and they put some verbiage, which I guess we understand subsequently was not legally binding. You get the GPLAT, by the way, continue to negotiate with HVAC, and you know, without anything concrete defining what that means. So yeah, it's unfortunate. We did have a follow-on discussion, and it didn't lead to anything. There was nothing to agree to. So it is very unfortunate. Mm-hmm. Now, we're not giving up. I mean, maybe there'll still be opportunities, and you know, and obviously we'll continue to look at other developments. But, you know, maybe there'll still be some opportunities. Because what's very unfortunate is that the CBA really is a win-win.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll use an example how you know, the union project is going, and we had the construction project. And just because of the dialogue and the regular exchange, you know, with the developer and with the construction company, I think we're avoiding a lot of issues that otherwise would just, you know, fester until there were problems. We don't have that dialogue, unfortunately, with Opus and with this new, you know, project. And I think they're going to be at a disadvantage for that is just as much as us. So.
Well, let me – oh, go ahead.
I agree with Henry. And many of the things that we were asking for in the CBA wouldn't cost them any money. So we were very aware that they had felt like they went through the PAD process. They had already spoken to some people that they felt were the stakeholders. This was before we actually kind of came together as a coalition. So many of the things that we were asking them for were really simple things like – these open meetings,
like the union,
which actually makes a big difference to people that are having to deal with dust and noise, and sometimes it's just about people being heard. So, like Henry said, I really think they're doing themselves and us a disservice by not looking further into this.
Well, let me just ask you this because I'm curious. I did talk to Tom Warren, who represents the Partners on Fourth Investment Group, which is the site where the new Opus building is going to be constructed. And he felt, and I think Steve Kosicek also felt, that the developers actually were contributing some of the things that the coalition would be happy with. So I want to just read those two, and I'm curious to see how you respond to that. You brought up already the parking issue. And what you talked earlier about restaurants and bars, you know, struggling because there's not enough parking. And
well, actually, what I said was that they aren't able. It's actually an opposite issue that when someone wants to open a bar or restaurant using the underlying zoning, they are actually required to. It's like an inordinate amount of parking that they would have to create or somehow come up with. Bars and restaurants that opened on 4th Avenue under the old zoning actually have to go rent a parking lot from somebody so that they have enough parking spaces, even though they're not next to their property. So that's one of the things the IID like cuts out. Like, you can basically have no parking, which is, now you can go into this.
Before you do, because I know what you're going to read, because I've heard this before, but I want to put it into a little bit of context. What you're going to read is basically a set of agreements that were part of the PAD process.
Can you just explain for our listeners what the PAD is?
PAD is a planned area development. So that is, it is an alternative, a customized zoning overlay for that development. So so those agreements were when that developer came in to purchase this property under the assumption that this PAD was approved, it's already committing to those. That is completely different now of applying for a GPLET and $5.5 million in tax incentives and what additional concessions might be associated with that. So I just want to make sure that's clear. Because those are some great things that were negotiated in the PAD. And some of it we're thankful were because of some of our, not before the coalition, but our Iron Horse Neighborhood Association, who's a member, negotiated some of the items there. So good things in there, but it was only the starting point. It was the basis of the PAD, and it really has nothing to do with the GPLET. So.
Well, would it be safe to say that the Avenue is going to benefit by some of these things?
Sure.
But it wasn't any of the agenda that you were hoping to negotiate.
Yes. Yeah. Correct.
Well, there are some things in the PAD that are a little bit confusing. Like, for example, we were, when the PAD first came up, we thought that we were told that they were going to be condos. So people buying things and living in an area is completely different than having four bedrooms, each with a bath, which means that basically they're going to be undergrads. Undergrads in something like this is completely different. We've already had two developments right in our area, and we have seen that they don't necessarily interact with the Avenue in the way that we wish that they could and would. So, for example, a lot of things that, and also in the PAD they said, you know, it's about localism, but the truth is they're only committing to making small spaces, and that commitment is only for 12 months. So that means, you know, after 12 months or 15 months, they can put in a CVS if they want to, which could be really hurtful to the co-op. We are extremely protective about our localism on the Avenue. It really is one of the only local hubs really left many places in the country. I mean, we see this changing. Shannon and I travel a lot. We see this changing all over. Mm-hmm. So it's really important that we are, like, I know that some people might see it as, like, hyper-protective, but at the same time, you know, it's a slippery slope. Once we start moving things in, what can, you know, other things can move in, and you can kind of change the whole dynamic or the ecosystem.
Well, it's interesting. Yeah. I'm so appreciative of your perspective because, for example, the reduction of retail space.
One of the arguments
is, well, we don't really need to make more of a commitment in a community benefits agreement to local merchants because we're going to downsize the retail space so that it would only appeal to a local merchant. I mean, that's basically basically the argument.
Yeah. Should we discuss each point on its own merit?
No, well, I don't think we have time. I don't think we have time, and I don't know that that's necessary. I was just, you've answered my question. I was really curious to know, given that you were really hoping for a community benefits agreement, I was curious to find out how you felt about some of these, what they perceive as concessions.
Well, let me explain, let me compare contrast that to what is actually in the community benefits agreement with the union, which is that not only did they commit to the small spaces for the 8 years of the GPLET, but they also committed to a rent control so that local businesses can't afford to be in those spaces. And they also committed to it. They have to be local businesses. It's not just, well, it's small so that local businesses can move in. They actually have to market those spaces to exclusively to local businesses for 6 months, I believe. If they're not able to rent it after 6 months, then we can revisit and find a way. Like, and then they have to come back and we have to talk about which business could go in there if it's not local. So there's a, you see the big difference between we took the 4,500 square feet, we made it 4,000 square foot spaces. We don't have any rent control, so we could be charging $30 a square foot for those spaces. And on top of that, after, if we can't rent those after 15 months, we can just put them back together and make a 4,500 square foot space. So there, even though it sounds good, and when we first heard it, we were like, oh, great. And also, there were supposed to be 10,000 square feet of commercial in this project to begin with. Yeah. And now there's only 4,500. So, I mean, that's, you can look at that however you want.
That would have been a great start if we had then accompanied that PAD requirement with our definition of local business and some of the rent growth. So then it would have been something, like I said, on par with what we were able to negotiate with the union.
And what I'm really hearing all of you say is this sense of a loss of partnership. That with union, you at least have a sense of partnership. They're still developers. They're still putting in a large building. Sure. You know, it's still going to change the aesthetic to a certain extent of the avenue.
Nothing we could have done.
But at least they are respectful of you, and they're opening themselves to partnering with you.
And that relationship is transcendent to the construction company. Everybody associated with that, there's good dialogue, and it really has been very, very productive.
I would say we've done events together. We had a mural event where we paid, you know, HVAC paid for half, and the construction company paid for half. We got local artists to do 23 murals that now surround the area. So there's so many creative, fun things that could come from these partnerships that Opus is choosing not to partake in.
I think Henry's point is very well taken. They're a national company. I know they're based in Minneapolis, and I think they have a major regional office, I believe, in Denver. And I am familiar with some of what's gone on. I moved here from Colorado. I'm familiar with what's gone on in terms of development in Colorado, specifically the Denver urban area. And I think that Opus probably didn't know what the heck to do with you guys.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure that there have been other coalitions in other areas where they do business. But I don't think they've come up against anything like what you have presented.
Yeah.
And
I think they almost treated us as if they were doing us a favor and we weren't seeing it. So, and I think Mike Peel made a really good point when he said, you know, they did that in Phoenix, but we are not, Tucson isn't Phoenix.
That's right.
And the people that live here, you know, we have a different idea about how we see community, about how we see equity, about how we see our roles in our community. Mm-hmm. So I think they are struggling with who we are and what we're looking for. Yeah.
So I want to talk a little bit about smart growth and some of the things that you've kind of alluded to, because I think that that's at the heart of all of this, you know, is how are we going to, or what can we do to influence how Tucson develops?
Sure.
And in your particular case, we're looking at the 4th Avenue and really your area too, right. West University, downtown. I mean, you know, I was just talking to someone earlier who wants to purchase a house. And they're looking at the east side, and they're not sure that it's the place to go. And I was just telling them, Central Tucson, Sam Hughes has outpriced a lot of people now. The east side is the next area. Get in there now, because in 5 years, you're going to have a valuable piece of property. Mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit about, you mentioned open space, walkability. That's a major issue.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure how the streetcar has affected walkability, but, you know, public spaces are
important. What you just said about the east side is super interesting. So it's affordable right now, right? Mm-hmm. And if you look at the downtown core, there are a lot of people who work downtown who work in the service industry, because don't we want all of our hotels and our restaurants and our bars to be staffed with all these wonderful people? But they cannot afford to live
right.
where mm-hmm. they work. And so we're talking about transit-oriented development and people being able to take public transit to their job. But all these people are getting priced out of where they work.
Well, we don't have enough transit for those people.
And that too, exactly. But if they could afford to live where they work, they can take one of those scooters or ride their bike or walk. Even if the streetcar doesn't go, you know, quite as far as all of us would, of course, like it to. But regardless, then those people are all being pushed out to the east side, to the north side, to Suarita, and
southwest side.
And then they have to come, they have to drive to work, or they have to find some other way to get. A lot of people Uber to their jobs. Think about how expensive that must be every day if you're working for minimum wage and tips, and then now you're having to take an Uber home because you get off at 3 o'clock in the morning with your pockets full of your tip money and you don't want to walk around in the dark, you know. So yeah, I mean, it can go
the
on and on.
Car doesn't run.
But it's an equity issue, and indeed. And if we're talking about transit oriented development, who is this transit for?
Mm-hmm.
And that's really, and you know, that's really what we're talking about: smart growth.
And I think another thing about smart growth is, like, really we want to what we're really trying to, I think, create here is that when these GPLETs or these tax incentives or whatever that are getting given away, they shouldn't be given away without community input. And that doesn't – so we're not just trying to build this. Of course we're trying to protect 4th Avenue because we feel like it's the heart of Tucson. It's where we live. It's where we grow things. I mean, that it really matters to us. But we want to see – like, let's say something's going on the south side. They're about to do the GPLET for the south side too. So we want those community people in that community to have a say-so. So mm-hmm. it really is about having people in the affected area have a seat at the table.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Anything you'd like to add to that, Andrew?
No, just to add about your, you know, what is smart growth, and you address the transit-oriented development. But all the details of a lot of the ideas are what are in the agreement with EDR on the union. You know, it's you know, public
and EDR is just for
gray
the benefit.
Star.
Oh, gray just star now. I'm sorry. Yeah,
thank
just
you.
Saying gray star.
And just for the benefit of our listeners, those are the developers of the union building,
union, right? So yeah. it's things there that we're building this community, this development, and mm-hmm. it's a valuable addition to the community,
mm-hmm.
and it's not an isolated island where it's just cut off. Because if it's cut off in their gated community, don't interact, then why live there? And why not just live somewhere else?
Right.
And you know, so.
Well, and I think everyone at the table is familiar with this article that Mike Truba just published, where he was talking about, you know, we're talking about community, we're talking about people living there and the livability. But I think, you know, he makes such a great point about how important small businesses are.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And how much people value small businesses, how much small businesses contribute to a community. And I can tell you, in my industry, where we now have huge investment groups called iBuyers who are coming in from out of this area, who don't know the area, who put an app on the phone, who allow anybody in the public to go into to their properties. There's no There's no service. That's my biggest complaint. I can't be of service to any of the people who I'm trying to serve. I'm committed to serving people. And these are digital outside investment companies, much as the developers who are developing properties in the area. And it's very disheartening.
Yeah.
And, you know, you begin to think, if our businesses are going to be taken over by investment companies, where are we all going to be?
Right. Yeah. Sure.
You know, what's going to happen? We won't have a community of any kind.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and everybody thinks all this stuff looks so glamorous and great. I mean, I know a lot of millennials who love this app. I don't need a realtor. I can go into a house all by myself. Well, there's a lot of inherent problems with that, including that we found people squatting in some of those homes. So I think that this is something that's going on kind of universally. And what Fourth Avenue is going through is this very local slice. And I just really admire, like, heck, the passion that you're bringing to it. And I think that we all have to just, I mean, Mark was here at the program where I was talking about my frustration with the iBuyers and the intrusion of outside investors, you know, in my community, in the area that I care very deeply about. So I know we're getting close to the end. And so I'm very appreciative of all of this information, but what I really want to do now is talk about some of the great stuff that the Avenue does have to offer, and there are some wonderful things coming up right now. So let's talk a little bit about...
Yeah.
Go ahead. You want to say something?
Oh, no. Shannon? I was going to say, I mean, I think that it's super important that we try to couch everything in positivity, that I feel like, unfortunately... We are hoping that what we're doing on trying to do good things for the Avenue isn't having a blowback of negativity towards the Avenue. Mm-hmm. And when you hear about somebody going out of business, it's sad and it's unfortunate. And we just want to make sure that everybody knows that even though there's construction, there's still 100 local businesses down there, great food, great drinks, great shopping, a lot of diversity. You can walk around all day. You know, watch the basketball game at a bar, go, you know, go shopping and have a great lunch. So we just went, and that's where we're leading to now, the good stuff, the fun stuff.
And and one of the greatest ways people can be supportive of the community that Fourth Avenue has created for all of us who are live in the Tucson area is through some of the events that are coming up. I mean, I don't know anybody who doesn't know about the Winter Market, which is the 12th, 13th, and 14th?
The 14th, Fourth Avenue Street Fair is the 13th, 14th, and 15th. 15th. It's the 50th Winter Street Fair. It's a big deal.
Yeah.
I have a really cool poster done by our neighbor, John Carrillo, and t-shirts that are going to be really cool.
Are those available for sale?
I believe they will be available at the street fair for sale, yes.
Fantastic.
And yeah, so there's that. And then coming up before that, we every year the Avenue does a Avenue-wide sale for Black Friday and Small Business Saturday. So PopCycle will have 20% off store-wide. If you look on Facebook Theater,
You can Facebook.
See all the specials that all the different stores are giving out, and some of the restaurants are doing specials as well. Small Business Saturday as well. And then on Sunday, the Made in Tucson Market is like a small, it's a street fair, but it's a small street fair on 7th between 4th and 5th. And it's all local artists, over 100 local artists with lots of also local nonprofits out there doing your gift wrapping for free for you and some kids activities. And it should be really, really fun. It's a great event. We've been doing it for about 3 years and people seem to be really loving it. It's great. So do all your shopping locally on the Avenue, and don't go to the mall and be sad. Go get some fresh air and be happy.
And I want to just encourage not only all of the people who live here, all of our residents, but we have so many snowbirds this time of year. So anybody who's here visiting, you have to come down to Fourth Avenue.
Okay.
You really must come down the street fair, the winter street fair, and the spring street fair. They're not to be missed.
Yeah.
So I really want to encourage everyone, and please come to the Small Business Saturday and the Tucson Local Market.
Yeah.
We have so much talent in this town.
It's crazy.
It just boggles my mind. I'm a music lover. I'm an art lover. And, you know, when I got here, I didn't know Tucson. I moved here from Colorado, from the mountains, and it just boggles my mind. It's like this little hidden gem.
Agreed.
And I hear that over and over and over again. Yeah. From I work with a lot of people who are coming here to visit and move or have second homes here. And I hear that over and over and over again. People come here a little bit like I did, like, oh, I'm not so sure about Tucson. And then after they've had a very short period of time here, they don't want to go home.
The way it's always described is we've got that small city feel, but we still have all the attractions, the opera, the ballet that the big city has. It's just it's perfect.
You took the words out of my mouth. I'm an opera lover. I'm an art lover. Yeah. I'm a theater lover. And I'm a people lover. And I've lived all over this country. I've lived all over the world. I used to live overseas. And I have to say, honestly, I have never lived in a town that is as friendly as Tucson is.
I agree.
I'm boggled away. I mean, I've never been in a Home Depot in any part of the country where somebody in an orange apron actually comes up to you and asks you if you want some help.
Or maybe even somebody who doesn't work there.
Yeah, really. Really. And and the other thing, you know, we hear so much about the traffic issue. Well, I don't understand that because even I happen to live in Oro Valley, but I can be downtown in a half an hour on a surface road.
It's not that bad.
I never have to get on an expressway. I never have to be in bumper to bumper traffic. Yeah. I never have to spend an hour getting and then pay 40. I used to talk about the opera when I lived in Chicago. I mean, and I lived in Evanston, which was a neighboring community, and it was an hour and a half at least on the traveling, and $35 to $45 to park in the garage. Or you had to go to a very expensive, lovely, but very expensive restaurant where they would valet your car while you were at the theater or at the opera. So, you know, I just, and what I was really going to say is I've never lived in a town where people let me into traffic either. You know, I go to the Trader Joe's on Oracle quite often, right around rush hour, 5:30, 6:30. I don't think I've ever tried to turn right out of that lot that somebody hasn't let me in.
Yeah.
I mean, I talk about community benefits.
Agreed. I mean, I think as Tucsonans, we try to practice kindness. And I mean, even as far as industry goes or small business goes, instead of there being, there's always the atmosphere of like, not enough, you know, like, but I think that Tucsonans treat things with the concept of abundance and wanting to collaborate and wanting to help each other. And I think that this coalition is a perfect example of why that matters and how we all came together. You know, a neighborhood and a district might have completely different needs, but we come together and we talk about what
ground.
We find more common ground than we find anything else.
Yeah. So. Well, I'm so grateful that you are all here today because I don't think that Fourth Avenue is the only district where we're going to be facing this. And I think that's one of the real values of the coalition. You know, West University is going through a lot of changes too. You know, and as we do grow as a city, I think the fact that the coalition exists and it can be an outreach to other communities. And I love that. And that may be the one way we will be able to keep Tucson.
Yeah, hopefully.
I mean, we could have talked for probably another hour about all of that, you know, as well. So definitely.
So thank you so much.
thank you for having us.
Shannon Riggs and Dee Dee Kanan and Henry Wurchel. Wurchen, thank you. Excuse me. And I want to wish everyone a wonderful holiday. Thanksgiving is coming up. Be sure and take your family and your friends down to Fourth Avenue.
That's
it's going to be going to be so much fun.
Yeah.
And, you know, forget about all the construction and all of the issues and just enjoy it because there's nothing like it.
Yeah.
And I just want to encourage any of my listeners, please feel free to call me, 520-448-6033. You can also reach me at email. I'd love to find out if you have areas of interest that you'd like me to address. I'm all about information, education, and forming coalitions. So please let me know if there's anything I can do to address any of your concerns. Thanks so much, everyone.
Thank you, Carol.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed Your Home for Real Estate with Carol Daggett on Tucson Business Radio X.